Welcome to the very first Debug Roundtable. I'm Renee Ritchie, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Guy English. How are you, Guy?
Great, thanks.
Also joining us is the legendary Brent Simmons, who you may know from apps like NetNewsWire, MarsEdit, and Glassboard. How are you, Brent?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
We're also joined by Justin Williams of Second Gear and Elements fame. How's it going, Justin?
Hello, sir. How are you?
And by the Kung Fu master behind Black Pixel and the just-launched Kaleidoscope 2, Daniel Pasco. How are you, Daniel?
I'm okay. I'm rolling my eyes as hard as I can. mandatory. Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Guy, our very first roundtable, and we're using it to talk about iCloud, and more specifically the part about iCloud that uses Core Data Sync. And it's been getting a lot of attention lately. I think I first read about it when the guys from Instacast said they were not going to be using it. And then Steve Strezza of Pocket wrote about it. Both Daniel and Brent have written great pieces on it. Rich Siegel from Barebones Software has written about it recently.
That's true. And apparently everybody's in a bad mood about it. I think people have been complaining about the iCloud Core Data Sync for a while. But it kind of came to a head, I think, after Daniel, after you sort of gave your State of the Union for NetNewsWire, which kind of got picked up by Alice Hamburger at the Verge. And I think that it's the Verge article is being sort of the major flashpoint for the discussion. So why don't you give us a little recap of what you said in the article?
Sure. I mean, basically what had happened was, Google announced that they were discontinuing Reader. And Brent, who is a great guy, had talked to me, and we'd been thinking about it, and he strongly encouraged me to say something about what was going on with NetNewsWire. And so I just tried to come up with a fairly concise summary of like, okay, well, sync's important. We're gonna deal with that. We'd been working with iCloud and Core Data, and it hadn't worked for us, and so we're moving on to something else. And I was actually shocked that it got the attention that it did, because I've seen plenty of people come forward and say, you know, we're ditching iCloud and Core Data. And I kind of thought that what I said was actually extremely low key by comparison. And it got pounced on. I mean, like we got approached by Wired and USA Today and a couple of other places that wanted more information about it. I was very surprised.
Well, I guess, I mean, NetNewsWire is sort of a news junkie's piece of software, right? So You know, when there's news pertaining to that and Apple, it kind of lights up everybody's interest board.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So NetNewsWire, Ben, I mean, you famously shipped NetNewsWire, what, 2001 kind of thing?
2002 for NetNewsWire Lite, yep.
Okay, yeah. And originally it didn't have sync.
That's right, it didn't have sync for years.
Yeah. And so if I'm not wrong, one of the reasons that you hooked up with NewsGator was to provide sync, right?
That was the big technical advantage, because doing it on my own, especially in those days, 2005, you know, there's just no way I couldn't have done that. So here's a company that has a big syncing platform and a whole bunch of clients, but didn't have a Mac client. And so it was really just an obvious fit. I had the best Mac client, and they had the only syncing system going. And frankly, it was a good system anyway. So I was happy to put that together.
Yeah, and syncing had become the big sort of the most requested user feature, right?
Yeah, by far. Yeah, and it was obvious, I think, at least to many people, that coming down the road were going to be phones. And RSS readers were going to be on those too. I mean, we had phones, but we had Trios or something. But we knew it was going to get a whole lot better before.
Yeah, I think to me that is what really makes sync sort of necessary these days.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Just because, you know, I mean, not if I have two Macs and my news isn't in sync, well, it's annoying.
Mm-hmm.
But especially in 2005, I could understand it. But these days, with everything's being ubiquitous, it's kind of an non-starter. I think you need some kind of sync solution.
Yeah, it's just part of the baseline. Got to have it for RSS and so many other apps. Yeah,
it's kind of interesting as we're all developers, right? So you know, it's like having your katana. You've got your laptop with you. So it kind of goes with you wherever you go. We don't necessarily have a desktop machine at work and a desktop machine at home, especially for those of us who, you know, may not actually even have an office. I think for us, for sure, you know, Mac to Mac sync isn't that important. But I just realized, like, well, we may not be the target audience for that either.
Right.
That's all.
You just name dropped a katana and you said you're not a kung fu master. That's impressive.
Sorry, I'm a dork. What can I say?
So the deal is basically NetNewsWire is at this point in time based on back in history is based on a proprietary syncing platform from NewsGator.
That's correct.
And at some point, NewsGator kind of gets out of that game, and the move is to Google Reader, right?
Right. And it was the obvious move. A bunch of other client apps had already done that. And it was by far our biggest feature request. People wanted not just sync, but sync specifically with Google Reader. So it was a pretty obvious move to make at the time. I hated it in a lot of ways because I didn't trust that Google Reader would be around forever. And their API was undocumented and unsupported. We got a little bit of official help. Or unofficial help, but, you know, that's not really the same as having a real API that's supposed to not change on us and have documentation and everything.
Is there a reason they didn't want to support an API?
Yeah, but I don't recall what it was.
Okay, so but obviously not compelling enough that you were like, oh yeah, okay, that's a good idea.
Yeah, no, I have no idea. I think it was just one of those things, well, we didn't actually finish an API, so, or we haven't had anyone design it, or I think that may have been all there was to it.
We have no engineers assigned to this task.
Yeah. Right. But that kind of told me that they didn't care about it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, to me, it seemed like a giant red flag of ambivalence, you know, or like a lack of real commitment to it. You know, it's kind of like the person you're dating who won't actually tell their friends that they're dating you yet, you know, not having a public API that they're committed to meant that they could change whatever they wanted to change, or even say like having an API isn't really something that's actually officially supported. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a shocking omission for something that was so heavily leveraged by so many different apps and people.
Yeah.
The API wasn't official because I think Google thought with Reader, the best way that they're going to monetize that is showing you ads. And if everyone's just dumping everything into NetNewsWire, how are they going to be able to monetize that without kind of taking that Twitter route and saying, all right, you can't use any client but ours, or we're just going to pipe ads into it itself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think what happened, I have no idea what happened with it, but my guess is like somebody spent like 20% time or whatever, built an API for it, people discovered it, and so many people hooked into it, it would have kind of been a little bit shitty for him just to like shut it off right then and there. Mm-hmm. Not that it wasn't shitty for him to do it now, but.
Sure. Yeah. I was going to say, I wonder about the monetization, right? Because so many feeds are already using FeedBurner, which Google bought. And so they were displaying ads.
Right.
In Google Reader and in NetNewsWire and many, many other places.
Right. To me, for Reader, that seems like the knowledge that they would get from seeing like what people are reading, what articles they're spending time on would be valuable. I don't know if there's necessarily a way for them to track that in a third-party app, but there should be some sort of way to use that in terms of like showing you advertisements in other Google services.
So I'm glad you mentioned Twitter, because I think sort of Google Reader, I think there's a lot of experimentation in terms of Twitter clients, because you can just hook into Twitter and you've got the same timeline and you've got the same social graph and all of that nonsense. And I think Google Reader sort of became the de facto backbone that RSS clients would plug into. So we did see like a fair, like when you went to NetNewsWire, when you went to NewsGator, Brent, there wasn't that many well-maintained news readers out there. And I think since the iPhone and since the sort of dependence on Google Reader, there was like a little explosion of interesting apps.
I don't know. The apps have changed since then. Back in the mid 2000s, Newsfire was around, and that was pretty cool. Pulp Fiction was okay. Shrook, maybe the weakest of them, but still popular, and had syncing, which the developer wrote on his own, actually.
What was the open source one?
Well, Vienna. Vienna? Oh, geez, Vienna. I forgot about that one. Yeah, Vienna. Also interesting. A lot of people liked it. So, you know, there were some good for the time RSS readers then. And I don't know if any of those still exist, and there are different new ones now. Reader's quite good. Mr. Reader is, I haven't tried it, but I've heard it's also good. I don't know if it's really all that different. There's just a few good ones at any given moment in time.
Okay, that's good. I was wondering if maybe, and this is going to loop back to iCloud in a bit, but wondering if maybe the having one target to write for, which is basically Google Reader, made it easier to write RSS clients.
You know, that's not the biggest thing, right? You can handle parsing different RSS feeds and the networking and queues and stuff that you need to do to write an RSS reader, whether it's against Google Reader or whether you're reading the feeds directly. The hard part is still things like database storage and especially user interface. That all takes the time.
Yeah, I agree with Brent. I think, I think the main thing in favor of Google Reader is just its ubiquity. I mean, it was kind of hitting the point of being like a monopoly in this space. Like, this is what people were using. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the interoperability. If you write a desktop client or an iPhone client that works with Google Reader, then you don't have to worry about providing the rest of the ecosystem. You could, but somebody could use a different piece of software on their Mac or Windows Phone or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. So keeping in mind then that turns out the database layer is the tough one. Brent, you've gone back and forth on using Core Data internally, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I for almost every app I write, I do one version in Core Data that never ships, and just end up using SQLite more directly via Gus's thing, FMDB. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to like Core Data. I have used it a little bit in shipping software, but mostly not. Last time I used it, I think, was NetNewsWire Lite 4 for Mac, and it worked out okay. But if I had worked on it for another month, I would have ripped it out and gone with SQLite.
So obviously you find it compelling enough that you keep going back to it. You haven't just totally tossed it aside.
Yeah, there's some things it makes easy that I like.
Yeah. So what are the like brief pros and cons about it? Because I want to kind of cover this as to, and then we'll talk about how it's so badly broken with iCloud Sync.
Well, let's see. Core Data, my favorite part of it is that it makes relationships between objects very simple. Whether it's one to many or many to many, whatever, you're just manipulating sets. And that's just very, very nice. And if you're having to do that more manually by talking to SQLite more directly, then you've got to have some kind of lookup table or some way to relate one thing to other things. And, that can be a bit of a pain, and you have to maintain that all correctly. On the other hand, I can do stuff that nobody using Core Data would do. I can make bigger, more scalable, faster, better tuned systems than anybody else using Core Data can. And that matters a lot to me. And partly that's just experience that I've shipped software that wasn't fast enough and didn't scale well enough. Once I got John Syracuse on the NetNewsWire beta testing list years ago, and him and other people like him had massive amounts of feeds, way beyond what I thought was reasonable for a human. And it had to work. I'm like, wow, this is really, really difficult. So in the intervening years, I spent a lot of time on learning how to make that stuff work fast. And of course, on the iPhone, it's, 1,000 times more important even.
One of the first things we did was actually audit the code base, and, I got a lot of counsel from Brent as well. And so, we opted to move forward with, the NetNewsWire 4.0 Lite code base as the starting point for 4, which is what we're working on now. And so, that was using Core Data. And Brent totally knows this, but one of the things that's a really strong advantage of using something like FMDB is say you've got 10,000 articles and you need to mark them all red. With Core Data, you have to iterate through all of them and mark them as red. And with FMDB, you make one call and it is orders of magnitude faster. especially on iPhone. And and Apple is not interested in supporting something like the ability to do that kind of bulk operation.
Right, because I mean, Core Data is not just a database layer; it's sort of an abstraction, right? It's an object layer that happens to serialize behind the scenes for you.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
Yeah, like they don't present you with a table or anything, so you can run a SQL statement on it.
Right, and I mean there are times when it would be just really really tempting because like you totally could just flip open the SQLite database using FMDB or something like that and just mark everything under the hood. But I think, just given like the whole doctrine against private API calls and that kind of thing, I've never had the nerve to actually ship something like that.
Well, who knows what it'll break too, right? There could be all kinds of caching layers that just totally...
Yeah, and I've seen some weird interactions spoofing the app directly through the SQLite database before when I've been testing. And I'm like, I don't think that was really a good move. So, it's probably something that you wouldn't want to do. Right.
Justin, what's your take on Core Data?
So I use Core Data in Elements. It basically powers the in-app search, which is a really horrible thing to do for full text search. You should really, there's hacks that you can do where you basically do pop in like your own version of SQL that does full text search. But yeah, I use it for that and for populating the actual directory listings and keeping track of that Dropbox metadata. So for me and for things like that, it's pretty nice, but it's not without its faults. The full text search, like I said, is kind of a mess, but I've used FMDB before. I used it back before Core Data was on the iPhone. It's really nice, but I mean, the tools are there. It's really easy for me to just pop in Core Data stuff and get a data model up and running within an hour.
Have you had any like upgrading problems? Like one of the things that I've found sort of frustrating with Core Data is sort of like updating the schema from old file formats. Has that been a problem?
It has been a little bit on the Mac side. I haven't had too much issue on the iPhone. So I did an update to my little GitHub notifier committed probably a couple months ago, and I changed the schema on it. And I would get some weird issues where users would just have like some of their data would be blown out in terms of it just not showing up in a data field, even though the migration happened. So it's not perfect, but trying to do that in SQL manually isn't easy either. So,
right.
Yeah. I've found the lightweight migration to be pretty painless, but I've had code in the past where I've, when I've shipped an update and I've got to check the database version and then do all the SQLite calls and that kind of thing to update the database. And it's been, especially considering you don't know what version you're going to run into. You have to like sequence all these things to make sure that they get upgraded correctly. And I found it to be fairly complicated, but I'm not Brent.
With my stuff is usually like with Elements, I'm hitting against Dropbox and pulling an S, and basically I'm pulling out their API stuff and just wrapping in there. So what I do with each new version, if I have to put a new database, and I just blow it out and just create a new file and just resync everything.
Mm. So here's a question. What happens with iCloud Sync when you have two different versions of the app that expect different schemas for your Core Data thing?
No. I didn't even think of that.
Like if Sony doesn't update their Mac and they update their iPhone and you've got two different schemas.
I think it depends on how radical the change is. Some of the stuff... I think would just work. It's a transaction log for each update for each property, right? I'd done some testing around this, but it was last year. And, I think some of the things you have to do with this are compatibility testing. But the fact of the matter is that was the least of my problems. So,
yeah, but just as an illustration of just how crazy this kind of shit can get.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy to figure out ways that this is just a very, very difficult problem for Apple to solve. And without having transparency into the code and exactly what's going on, it's almost impossible for third-party developers to try to make it work. So, Justin, why don't you tell us, because I think you've got a reasonably well-defined and pretty straight-up use case for Core Data, but you still don't, you won't be doing Elements for iCloud, right? So why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so mine is completely unrelated to Core Data. oddly enough. But Elements, for those that don't know, is basically, it's one of those Dropbox and Markdown syncing text editors. It was the first one, LOL. But it's one of those, and I've wanted to do for a long time an iCloud version just because, one, it's a lot easier for me to manage because it's not having a third-party dependency on Dropbox. Two, it's good for my users because one of the hindrances people have with jumping on the app is, well, first they're like, well, it's $5. But the second thing they're always kind of frustrated with is if they don't have a Dropbox account. And for anyone that's listening to this show, they've got a Dropbox account. But if you try to get like my mom to use the app or your mom to use the app, they probably know what Dropbox is, but they don't have an account or they don't want to have to deal with all of that stuff. And so I've wanted to do iCloud for a while, and I've actually got it mostly built, but there's just so many weird edge cases with things like renaming files not taking effect for so long that it ends up getting out of sync. Files that I've deleted will just magically reappear out of nowhere, even though everything I've looked at and showed other people shows that these files have been closed and are deleted, all the way to things where it's just the container that has all the files will just get completely just hosed beyond belief. And the only way to resolve the issues is to blow it out and start from scratch. And for me, I don't ever want to have to tell my users during support that the only way to fix my app is to basically go to their Mac or their PC and delete all these files from a container and start from scratch, because just deleting it from the app itself wasn't fixing that. You have to actually clear out your iCloud cache.
Ouch.
And for me, it's not worth that extra amount of support. I don't want to give my support guys that headache for something that's I have zero control over. Like bugs that I can fix I feel like are my bugs, those are ones I'm okay with. I don't want to ship things where more often than there's going to be several times that even me in development, I've seen that corruption happen. I don't want to ship something with that kind of really shitty corruption bug.
I think probably everybody listening to this knows what iCloud is. But let's just reiterate. So there's, you know, like Mail doesn't use it, although it says it's iCloud enabled. It uses document syncing behind the scenes, like the calendar sync, but they use CalDAV, the content sync, but they use CardDAV. Notes uses IMAP. PhotoStream is its own thing. iTunes is something totally different. Bookmarks uses Key Value Store, which ubiquitous key KVS, which works pretty well. And then the two big ones are document syncing and Core Data iCloud syncing. So for the document syncing, it's as if every app on the system has its own little Dropbox called a container. And the files get, in theory, copied back and forth between all the machines so that everything's in sync. And Core Data is a layer on top of that where the updates are down at the individual object level, right? Like the individual commits or individual transactions is it properties or is it like entire objects at once?
It happens on a per property basis.
Okay.
So you get basically a merge notification and you can see, you know, like basically which values have changed and that kind of thing. But there's, so you can do data fusion. You know, like if one host changes one property and another host changes the other, it's intended to give you back the, you know, the union of those things.
Also worth pointing out that, you know, unlike some online services where you have a single store of the truth on a server and then views and caches of it, the vision for iCloud is sort of peer-to-peer and every device is equal.
Yeah, that's definitely another extra layer of complexity, because it's not like you just upload everything to, which I believe is what Dropbox does, is you everything's held on their servers and all of the computers just sync. So Dropbox holds the truth. For iCloud, just the computers in the user's sort of iCloud network exchange transactions, basically change requests.
They can opportunistically detect each other across like a Wi-Fi network and exchange information.
Yeah, but is Apple holding the truth for
the
containers?
Yeah, I mean, iCloud is a file replication system, right? So, I mean, that's what it is at its heart. So it is something like Dropbox. You dump a file on one machine, it gets replicated on another one. You can actually go online. They have debugging tools, so you can actually go and see the files that are actually stored out on the server.
Like if I make a change in the two things on the network, two clients on the network swap their transactions, they can be in a different state than what is the truth up in the cloud, right?
No, I think that's part of the problem is how you know, conflict merging and that kind of thing. I'm pretty sure, but
Yes, well, so on the document side, let's say I edit a file on my iPhone, and then at the same time I edit it on my iPad, and then they both get pushed up to iCloud. The next time that my metadata query updates, it's going to send back information saying, hey, this file is updated, and it's going to also have a key on it that says it's in conflict, and it'll show you which different versions that you have of the file. So comparing that to something like Dropbox, whenever I do any sort of metadata queries on that, what it's sending back is basically just a revision number, and that's something I have to compare on my side. So mm-hmm. with iCloud, they're trying to basically abstract out all of that stuff so that I'm not doing any sort of comparisons, and it's just saying, all right, you've got this file, it's been updated, or all right, this file's been updated, but it's in conflict. Put it on the user to figure out which one it is. So it's they're like 75% of the way the exact same, but then the 25% difference is basically how they show things like conflicts and showing what has changed between the files.
Sure. That makes sense.
So what goes wrong? You know, clearly NetNewsWire is being stalled due to iCloud syncing.
Yeah.
Well, you guys are smart and you've been at it for a while, so I imagine there's a bunch of crazy stuff that happens.
Well, I mean, the first thing that I'd say is of the three iClouds, you know, between key value store, documents, and core data sync. Key value store is considered to be very well done. And everything I've heard about it suggests that it's robust and very fast. The problem there is that there's a limit to how much data you can store there, but that's considered to be very reliable. There have been ongoing reports of continuous issues with document storage, and to the extent that Tim Wood at Omni just kind of gave up and they went and did their own implementation. But it's working for a lot of people, and Apple's making apps that use it. But there are definitely some issues. We ended up using Ubiquitous Files for basically keeping some breadcrumbs around in the iCloud container for us to use. And there were bugs that we were finding in versions of Mountain Lion and that kind of thing, where we were depending on the presence of a file to know the state. And if the file disappeared, then we would make some assumptions and take some action based on that. Like somebody had reset their data, for instance. One of the things that happened with that in the version of Mountain Lion that we were using was that you didn't get any notifications if a file in a subdirectory in the container got deleted. And I ended up having to go through a bunch of hoops and provide some sample code for it and get the bug confirmed and stuff. But there are issues ongoing that they're kind of quashing with the document store. And the first problem is that there are issues with that. And then core data is built on top of that, still not completely firm foundation. So, you know, Brent did a phenomenally great blog post on why things like Dropbox and that kind of stuff weren't really appropriate for something like, you know, like a newsreader. And, you know, one of the Brent, you can speak to that if you want to. I think it's an interesting thing and we should include a link to it somewhere. But this is like a much, much, much more ambitious case of that kind of thing where you have files all over the place that are meant to represent, you know, incremental changes to your database. And there are all sorts of ways that it goes wrong. And there are known cases where you can induce a conflict. Just like doing some offline changes and that kind of thing that, you know, the people at Apple are aware of. But I think first and foremost, the fact that it's based on something that is not yet totally ironed out is problematic in itself, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's no replacing a smart server with a database and a smart API. Even Google Reader's API isn't very good. But, you know, it sure worked a hell of a lot better than iCloud does. And for a lot of apps, especially a lot of database-driven apps, I just think that that's what you have to do. I don't really see this kind of transaction-driven thing really ever working all that well. It's a nice science project, but yeah, that's just not the way to sync these kinds of applications.
Right. So you would rather have some sort of brains in the cloud rather than just having
absolutely
like a dumb store. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. An API that I can, you know, that I can write to and that I know what's going on. You know, that I know the state of the client app at any given moment, unlike with iCloud where data just kind of appears maybe. That system just works way better. You know, I've written a lot of that kind of software over the years and it's, you know, it's a nice model. It works. Now it breaks down if the thing you're talking to isn't actually done very well, but you know, assume that it is and you can write great client software for it.
I haven't done anything with the core data stuff on iCloud just because I've heard all the horror stories and pain and it's just, I want to stay as far away from that as possible. But I don't, at the same time as I don't want to use it, I also don't want to use it because I just don't want to be locked into Apple's ecosystem. Like I don't want to say, because if I'm building something that requires like some sort of online backend and sync service, it's more than likely that it's something that I also want to have on other platforms and I don't want to just limit it to Apple's. So if I can get something where I've built it myself or it's built on a platform that does sync across everything, that's way more comfortable for me. And pretty much everything else out there seems to be far more reliable than what Apple's offering too.
Well, I think Apple should care dearly about syncing, about they should care that all those apps in the App Store are able to sync and that it's not a giant burden to developers. And also that users maybe get the single sign-on benefit that iCloud is supposed to bring us, right? You don't have to create a new account or something. I would love to see Apple create some kind of system that we developers can use where we go in and set up our database and say, here's our schema and here's our API. In most cases, it'll be pretty simple stuff.
Like the Windows Azure stuff that you're...
Sure, yeah. And, you know, Apple could do this because it's theoretically doable. And, you know, just, you know, for an extra $100 a year or whatever, you know, you get this. And that would be really, really cool. And they could make it so nice, so easy. But I just don't imagine them doing that. That seems like a little bit against their DNA to go quite that far as providing services to developers.
Do they need to? I mean, other people are already doing it, right? Like Amazon and Microsoft and other people too.
It makes the platform a lot more attractive. Mm-hmm. And they want to hold on to that, right? They don't want to see people writing apps for other platforms. They want the best apps to be written for iOS than for Macs.
Sync is something that they've also kind of promised to users in terms of like everything that you've got on your iPhone is going to magically show up on your iPad. And if you've got a Mac too, great. If there's a Mac app that's a companion, then it's going to work there. And outside of the Apple apps, which we've listed, aren't necessarily using iCloud. They're using CalDAV and CardDAV and IMAP. That promise is really hard to come by. I don't know. I can't really think of any mainstream app that successfully deployed core data syncing through iCloud. There's certainly a couple apps out there that are doing the UI document stuff that I'm having issues with, but it's if they want to have this promise of having everything on all of your i devices wherever you go, they're going to have to fix it, whether or not it's in their DNA or not.
Yeah, it seems like they're thinking like a client company rather than a services company.
Mm-hmm.
I think they can, and I had been in touch with people at Apple before, and I have kind of been less involved now, just focusing on, you know, moving forward. But I think that there are some things that need to shift, and hopefully they have already. You know, Apple has a very siloed culture, and I used to work at Lockheed Martin Astronautics, and in the defense programs, you know, if you've got a culture of secrecy, you have somebody working on, like, people could be working on the same thing, and all they know about is the interface requirements for the part that they're working on. And there's, like, higher-level people that are actually integrating all this stuff. But, you know, this is the kind of thing where you need to have, you know, cross-functional initiatives with multiple teams basically getting time together to work on things. And because there are some things that would be considered to be a server-side issue, and there wasn't really anything the client-side guys could do about it. You know, and if this is to be taken seriously, you know, like a whole bunch of people need to get in the same room and make it a priority to figure out what the problems are and knock them down. And I think that, you know, this is conjecture, but I think that to some degree, I think that as a culture, Apple wasn't really aware of how egregious the situation was until it was too late. And, you know, hopefully, you know, there are some very good people working there and there's some very smart people working there. And I'm hoping that they'll pull through on this, but I don't know.
Too late, meaning what? When they shipped, the original iCloud implementation back in 10.7?
Well, I mean, like back in 10.7, like last year, you know, the evangelist that I was, you know, basically like working through for a lot of the radars I was filing and that kind of thing. And for some of the things, he was kind of like, are you serious? Like this issue reporting, this seems pretty basic. And I said, I've got the test code here. I ended up having to basically provide a code sample that demonstrated the issue. And he's like, if what you're saying is true, this is really, really bad. Mm-hmm. And I just think that people were not seeing the kind of issues that people out in the wild were seeing. And for whatever reason, even though a lot of people were reporting this stuff, it wasn't getting acted on. You know, I know that with iOS 5, there was they had the iCloud Core Data Recipes app. And if you look back in the forums back in 2011, there were a lot of people who were reporting problems that, like, if you ran the app and then you, at some point, it would work. Okay, so you'd run this thing, you could sync your recipes. Yay, that's really nice. And then if you deleted the app and then build and ran again, it was done. Like that container was not going to work again. And so uninstalling the app and reinstalling it would kill the ability of that device to sync anymore. And I mean, that's a pretty significant issue. You'd have to actually change the name of your iCloud container or go and, I believe that just deleting all the data would work, but this thing would get wedged and there was nothing you could do about it. I think I actually ended up reinstalling the OS, like just totally, totally wiping the device. And then I was able to get it working again. But, you know, these people were reporting it and stuff wasn't really happening. And I don't really have anything to say about that. I don't know why. It's unfortunate though.
Is that similar to, I mean, we had Lauren Brichter on talking about Game Center and he was basically the first one to significantly use Game Center. So he felt all the pain and he's the one who knocked it over. And aside from trailers, Apple didn't really use Core Data Sync. So again, it's the developers who hit all the pain points first. And that seems almost untenable. If Apple dog-fooded this stuff more, if they always made sure they had a skin in the game by having an app that, you know, showcased that feature, maybe they'd have more impetus to change it faster.
Mm-hmm. I'm not even aware of an Apple app that really uses Core Data.
Apparently trailers.app does, but not well.
Trailers does.
I've heard the same. Yeah.
It has an extremely simple model. Apparently, like the complexity of the model is a factor, but also I've also heard people say that there are issues with it too. They're just not as severe.
You lose your favorites, or you lose something.
Yeah.
The app.
Do any of their pro apps use Core Data?
iCloud Core Data,
or not even iCloud, just Core Data. Period.
I would think so, but I don't know. I mean, it's pretty pervasive. Core Data works. You know, there are, you know, a few edge case issues here and there, but there are also workarounds for them.
But if you have a Core Data based app and you turn on iCloud syncing, what happens? Because I know when you're setting up the persistent store, you have to pass it some flags to tell it that you actually want to use Core Data syncing.
Yes.
What happens if you don't pass those flags but your Core Data file is sitting inside the container, the Ubiquity container?
Well, then it's just treated as a regular database. And you can, you know, there's been some movement back and forth about like where you actually put the database for one thing. It doesn't have to be in the container. The transaction logs have to be in the container. Part of the rationale for putting the database in the iCloud container is that it would leave with the directory if you changed accounts. Yeah. And so that was perceived as being a way to simplify things a bit. But basically, if you open up you know, a ubiquitous database without those flags, it's just a data store. If you have a database with data in it and you set it up for the first time, it'll migrate everything for you and it becomes like, you know, an iCloud synced database in theory. Mm-hmm. The iCloud core data APIs, I've got like 6 calls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a complicated thing. You know, it was intended to be a really, really simple thing. And, I spent the first 2 days when I was working on this thing, just gutting all of the code that I had put in place to deal with increasingly difficult circumstances from trying to play nice with iCloud. You know, we had data that we didn't want to sync. So we had to partition the database, because you can't actually, it's all or nothing. You can't say, don't sync this, do sync this. It's like everything in the database gets synced. They've done some things to give you notifications if the user switches, but the fact of the matter is, if the user logs out and logs back in as somebody else, your database goes away. And I've never, ever seen anybody design a core data app where they put in guards to make sure that the database is still there. It's like somebody just goes into the directory and types rm minus rf, like the database. And bad things happen, particularly if you're doing a lot of processing. You know, so we've got paranoid code like all over the place to, you know, like, oh my God, is the database here? You know, and the other thing is that, opening, a core data persistent store is pretty snappy, but opening the iCloud container can take a long time. I mean, I'd seen like 10 to 15 minutes. Rich Siegel is still reporting seeing up to 25 minutes to open up the iCloud container, and you can't do anything that would require writing to that container until it's open. So you have.
Does that mean you can't write to the database in that period of time?
Wow. Well, I mean, we had things compartmentalized so that we could, but I mean, again, you're just like making this more and more complex to try and deal with these things. Like I wanted the app to like show up and be usable immediately. And that meant trying to defer things and leave breadcrumbs to put into the iCloud persistent store whenever it came up later.
What do you mean by opening the Ubiquiti container, first of all? Like what kind of call would you do for that?
Okay. Well, it's the call with the flags that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so setting up the persistent store, right?
Yeah. So setting up the persistent store, you know, if there's a bunch of data that needs to be synced, let's say, I mean, this is pretty hypothetical. But you know, you've got a bunch of transaction logs that have to be run through and they have to be downloaded and sometimes they time out. And so they have to retry and it needs to be able to build up state and merge everything in. Mm-hmm. And that can take a significant amount of time.
And that's just in the open call.
Just in the open call.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and it won't return your persistent store until all of that transaction has been done. Yeah.
Okay. So you need to do it asynchronously and, you know, then fire events like crazy. But I've got like a bunch of code that is no longer there. That was like, you know, so we're going to get the app up and running because we don't want to look like we've locked up.
Mm-hmm.
And, but now we're in this special weird mode where like we can't really support everything we're supposed to be supporting. And so we have to have a lot of checks to, you know, do we handle this the normal way or the, oh crap, the persistence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're sad because you don't actually have your data store, which is basically what your app is all about presenting. So
yeah. So that's not super great.
So Brent, you're not a server side guy.
Well, I used to be actually in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Oh yeah. I guess Userland server side. Right?
Yeah. I wrote Manila, which was not one of the blogging systems that really made it, but you know, I had, I don't know, 100,000 users or something at one time.
So does it feel natural to you to sort of just say, screw it, I'm going to write a backend?
It does actually, because the basic concepts haven't really changed. HTTP is still HTTP, more or less. So the main thing for me is just, you know, learning about the new technologies. You know, and oh, how do I choose between, say, Ruby on Rails or Node.js or whatever? And so far, I've just been enjoying looking at all this stuff and learning about it because, boy, in the last 10, 15 years, this stuff has changed a ton. And it is so much more fun and so much more interesting and so much less expensive, too, than it used to be. It kind of reminds me of when I went from being a Mac toolbox programmer to Cocoa. It was like turning on the turbojets. I could suddenly do so much more and do so much better work with so much less effort. And the world of server-side programming has kind of gone through a similar change over the years. For a Rip Van Winkle type, which is kind of the position I'm in, where I didn't pay attention for a long time. And now I look and I'm like, wow, really cool.
Yeah, that's cool. Cause I mean, I know very little about server-side stuff because I've never had to use it really in my career so far. Mm-hmm. Is there a cool place to start? Do you have like you love Cocoa, is there a sort of an equivalently exciting technology on the back end?
That's tough. I find a lot of overlap between people who love Cocoa and people who love Ruby. So I would probably push people toward Ruby on Rails, or maybe starting with a simpler thing like Sinatra. But I also find myself intrigued by Node. I don't love JavaScript, but it sounds pretty interesting.
It claims
huge performance, and I'm a massive performance junkie. So. Mm-hmm.
There's always been this psychological barrier I've had with the server side stuff, just because it's not my wheelhouse. And I've always, like, everything I'm working on right now for what we're doing in the future needs a backend component, but just getting over the barrier of, one, I don't know anything about the technologies, but two, like, dealing with scaling and dealing with the security implications, all that stuff is stuff I've never had to deal with on the client side, because it's just, all right, you run it on your iPhone, you run it on your Mac. Putting something like this server out on the web and having to keep track of, like, making sure it's secure and scalable is just, it's always been something that I know I need to do, but I just, something in my head is always so paranoid that I kind of just punt back and say, well, I'll try to do it a different way.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It feels like a bit of voodoo to me.
I think that was part of the appeal of the iCloud Sync in the first place, is not the fact that, you know, it's like, you know, that everybody's got an iCloud account. That's a perk. But the fact that you didn't have to worry about any of the hosting stuff, and that you didn't have to worry about scalability or anything else. It's like, okay, you know, this is basically, the person has a data allowance based on whether they've got a free account or they're paying for additional space. And, you know, you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And I think that honestly, concern about the same stuff Justin was talking about is kind of what had us dragging our feet about trying something else. Like, we wanted this to work because it sounded like it was going to be easy. Mm-hmm. And we weren't going to have to worry about those kind of big, scary unknowns, you know?
Yeah, we're using Ruby too for what we're doing. And then on the deployment side, it's just, look, Heroku is basically the easiest thing I've found for someone that doesn't really know what they're doing.
Like, That's what I use.
Yeah, it costs more upfront versus like setting up our own EC2 instances or whatever. But I used it at the old job. It's ridiculously easy just to go from a Rails app or a Sinatra app and get it up and running on the server. But still, it's the psychological barrier is the hardest part of any of the web stuff. Like, you can learning new technologies is easy for us, but just constantly worrying that my server is going to go down in the middle of the night is something that I'm going to need to see a doctor about, I think.
Yeah.
Do you do a lot of work on the back end?
I do, since I'm the only programmer right now. So it's just me and a designer. So I'm basically building the front ends and the back ends until we can scale this thing beyond what it is. But I mean, it's not like I'm building like giant scaled applications. It's basically, I need a relatively simple Rails app that has an API wrapped on it that I can hit from my app.
Brent, are you doing any back end magic these days?
I will be soon, I believe. Mainly I'm researching right now, playing around.
Yeah. And
I'm looking forward to it though. I think the days where we could wait for Apple to solve this problem are over. Can't wait anymore. And that means us app developers have to do this stuff.
Right. It's a fun distraction. Like, I really dig like playing with all these new technologies. Like, the last time I messed with Ruby and Rails was like Rails 0.14 or whatever it was years ago. And it's completely changed now. So it's a really fun diversion to play with. But at the same time, it's basically like you're building two apps at the same time. So it's adding a shitload of time on top of dev, because in addition to like building the client side, you've also got to build the back end that supports that app.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. But the one thing I will say that is really nice is like, you've got your Xcode window and you've got like BBEdit or whatever you're using for the service stuff. And it's like, there's a problem. You go change it, you know, like I have worked with, you know, like for our client services stuff, we say that we do involuntary web service quality assurance all the time, you know, where somebody's developing a back end and it's not us. And, you know, and like we hemorrhage time waiting for things to, you know, dealing with outages or dealing with bugs and that kind of stuff. And like the fact that I had like total control of both sides was probably the most efficient, high functioning development time I think I've ever had. You know, there's a problem. Fine. Switch Windows, fix it, switch back, you know, and I will say that that was pretty amazing.
Fun too, right?
Yeah, it was a blast. I was trying to come up with a proof of concept internally so that we could sell the idea of doing this to ourselves. And, you know, so there, I felt like there was a tight timeline, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, I was enjoying the hell out of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something I didn't get to do with NetNewsWire, but I would have loved it. That sounds great.
So you say you've been exploring. Do you have a technology you prefer right now, Brent?
Well, I've looked an awful lot, of course, at those guys who paid me to do the videos for them. And I really like what they've done because you can get something going really, really simply and still leave a lot of the worry and headache to other people, which is great. Mm-hmm. But then there's another part of me that's like, you know, I'd like to build a machine from scratch and do everything. Right.
I can't help style.
When I do that. So what I'll probably have to do is just, write a few different apps and try different approaches in each one just to satisfy every single possible itch.
So for Azure, what language do you deploy on it? Is it something specific to them, or is it actually know the answer to this question, but I'm setting you up for
it's, that. Yeah, it's JavaScript. They run, node.js up there and, yeah, it's JavaScript. I was really worried when they first contacted me. I thought it was going to be all C# and Visual Studio and stuff. And it wasn't.
Mm-hmm. No, that team in particular seems to have sort of embraced the wider world.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Yeah. And they're moving very quickly too. I'm really pleased with the rapid progress and stuff they're doing. So yeah, it's exciting. And, at first I was resistant to the idea of even thinking about doing server technologies again. But then, you know, I had the same worries everyone else did. But then, you know, looking at an easy system, I'm like, you know, I understood it pretty quickly. And I'm like, I could probably understand something a little harder. And, you know, and next thing I know, I'll probably be rewriting Apache in Assembler or something.
How did it work at Glassboard?
Well, we used Azure. We didn't use mobile services. And I didn't do any of the back-end coding. But we had essentially 1.5 developers on that. And it worked great. You know, haven't had any problems. And just fantastic. If that had not been true, I wouldn't have talked to those guys in the first place.
Right. Just occurred to me, you've been doing network connected apps.
I always do.
30 years.
Yeah, right. I wrote the first external weblog editor. It must have been like 1999 or something.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much my entire career. You know, from Userland stuff to NetNewsWire and Mars Edit and Taplinks and Glassboard, everything I've ever done has been databases and networking and usually table views.
Gotta get you into some OpenGL soon.
Yeah.
I fell asleep.
I was trying to learn OpenGL, but then all this server stuff came along and I'm like, you know, that's a bit shinier for me at the moment. So
it's probably actually more useful too.
That is, you know, it's a good practical case. Yeah.
There's less math. That's why I stick with the server side stuff.
I hate math so much.
I know.
Yeah. I'm actually really bad at math, but I do a lot of graphic stuff. Is this a problem for Apple? Like a really deep, I mean, obviously there's bugs. That's bad. But is this sort of inability to sort of give us what we need in terms of a flexible backend and even just functionality that they've promised us? Is this something that is really going to hit them?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a cultural thing. It's like Apple has never excelled at doing this web service stuff. If you go back to like iTools and iDisk being kind of flaky back in the day, MobileMe was a disaster. iCloud is better than MobileMe was, but it's still nowhere near perfect. Apple Maps, when it came out, was derided as not being that great of a service. There was ping. I mean, if you look at everything Apple has done that has required some sort of server-side connection, it hasn't exactly set the world on fire. And I think it's just their company.
Well, except iTunes, you know.
Yeah, well, iTunes works pretty well.
iTunes being the one exception, okay? But if you look at the one giant exception. But predominantly, I would say that they're a company that's very focused on client-side apps. Even then, iTunes is a client-side app. It doesn't have a web side to it. They're focused on client-side apps and building hardware. Doing this web service stuff is something that they've just kind of had to pick up and learn as they go on, as people like Google and Microsoft become more entrenched in that market and offer those services. You can't just have your calendar on your Mac and then use something like iSync and a USB cable anymore to sync it, because people expect it to just automatically update. And Apple can throw money at the problem. They can try to hire the best people that they can find to solve the problem, but it's definitely not something that they're going to solve overnight. And at this point, I don't know if they're going to solve it with iOS 7. I doubt they will, but I hope it's better than what it is now.
Right. It's kind of funny because when Next took over, the thing that Next was making money on was web objects and consulting. And they Next did or web objects ran the Dell store, the original online Dell store, and it ran the Apple store. So they actually came in with a bunch of knowledge and experience on the web. And it's definitely seemed to have eroded to the point where it almost seems like they have no clue what's going on anymore.
It stopped at web objects.
Very much so. Yeah.
Well, Apple has stunned and surprised me so much, so many times, that I'll grant that anything is possible. I don't know what they're going to do, and I'm pessimistic about it because this is one area that they keep striking out on. I mean, before iCloud, there was that sync services thing. That was around for I don't know how long. I don't know of hardly anybody that got that working, but it seemed like it might have worked a little bit better than iCloud Core Data works. I don't know. But what worries me the most is that people will start looking at iOS apps and say, it's too expensive to develop because I need to write my own server and do all this kind of stuff. Whereas on Android, Google has this wonderful service that is so easy and it's free for every developer to use. Heck, Microsoft could do the same thing.
That's a good point.
So part of this is, you know, you want the best apps. You want the best apps there first.
And so Apple's server side really now is a part of the platform.
Absolutely.
Three screens in a cloud. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what Microsoft says.
It's table stakes.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, actually, Microsoft says a lot of smart stuff. They just say a lot of dumb stuff, so it often
fails. Yeah.
But every now and then, they're right about stuff. Dan, what do you think? Is Apple hosed?
I know for a fact that there are people there that really give a shit about this and really want it to work and are not happy and they care. And, you know, the thing that concerns me is that Apple has had a history of not having a great deal of commitment to this stuff, and they do it and it doesn't work and they scrap it. And they've done that with a lot of things. And my fear is that, as far as like iCloud's not going to go away. They've made a big investment in that and they're using it for a lot of stuff. But in this particular case with the iCloud Core Data stuff, that may go away. And that really concerns me. And what I want them to do is, you know, basically suck it up and make it work. Because, you know, I think it's going to be a credibility hit for them to just say, well, yeah, it is bad and we got nothing. And I think the things that concern me are the fact that this is still being put out there as a viable technology. And it's very problematic for most of the people that I know, some of whom I really respect. You know, I feel like they could choose to take this very seriously and work on it. I believe it's a complex problem. I think that they had no idea how ambitious this was actually going to be. I believe it could be tractable, but I believe it would take a much larger commitment and work and money to make it happen. and I don't know if that will happen or not. Right. And honestly, when I reached the point where I felt like kind of looking back on the history and looking at where it was now, there started to be a non-zero chance in my own personal, it's total conjecture. I don't know anything about this. I started getting worried that it could go away, and I decided we should focus on something else. You know, if it does come about, I will add support for it because the benefits that are there, like as a secondary sync system, I'd be happy to use it.
But suppose they tell you that, oh, it's working out, Daniel, go ahead. Do you even trust that?
I would want to have my immediate needs addressed, and I would want enough time to casually check it out and see if it's working. If it was working, it really should be a matter of a few days to see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, if, and I would, you know, at this point, I'm emphatically not interested in investing any time in finding out if it's working. If somebody came to me and said it was, I'd be like, well, I already picked my track. I mean,
yeah,
right. Google Reader is, you know, has a termination date, and you know, and that's kind of forcing us to move pretty fast on this. So
what worries me about Apple though is that even if they do fix stuff, a lot of trust and credibility has been lost regarding syncing iCloud. Mm-hmm. And you know, every day that it keeps sucking is just that much harder to turn it around.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, honestly, like I think it's pretty obvious to anybody who knows me, but I'm staunchly in the pro Apple camp, you know, and I want them to have this win and I want it to work. I just don't know what to expect now. But I think that another failure here is just going to further erode the credibility in the space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have any idea if Core Data Sync was poorly designed or poorly architected or just poorly implemented? Like, is it a solvable problem, or do they have to rip and replace it with something that is better conceived and will work better?
It's a fairly complex problem, and I know that there are a lot of things that need to be fine-tuned. I would say that there are states that don't lend themselves well to a core data app. You know, this is a file syncing system. So if you change users, the current iCloud directory gets renamed and moved, and the other one gets put into place and resynced. So if your app is running, the directory that your core data store is in, you know, goes away if you've got the database in the cloud. I mean, in the container. There are a lot of, I guess there's just a lot of systems analysis that kind of hasn't happened, or there's a lot of things that we've found out. We're like, oh, okay, you know what? This really is complex, and there's a lot of different edge cases that needed to be handled. But even the regular functionality is problematic. You know, I guess, you know, the question is like, how complex is this? Is it doable? I think it's doable. The idea itself sounds very good. I think that it's just really important to realize the level of effort that's required to deal with this. And Apple works with very small teams.
Yeah. And is this one of those things that takes longer than a product cycle, like a year to get out, and therefore kind of suffers?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't know what it would take to get this on track.
I think it would take Apple actually using it in one of their apps in a large scale. I think that's the quickest way to get stuff like that fixed. Is because to me, Apple always seems like a company that they move in directions that are beneficial to Apple. And these are technologies that they've put out there because we have requested it through radar or whatever mechanisms, but it's not something that they're necessarily using themselves. I think a lot of the issues with UI document and the document sync stuff, I think a lot of those get fixed faster because Apple's using that stuff with the iWork apps and Pages and Keynote and what's the other one? Numbers. Whereas with the Core Data stuff, I think the only way that that's really going to get tested on a large, massive scale is Apple deploying a new app that uses it, and then they start getting these reports in, and that's when you're going to start seeing stuff get fixed. But until then, I have no idea.
I forgot.
What was the question?
whether they could fix Core Data Sync, or whether they had to rip and replace it with something better architected.
They should do that and call iCloud, and then everyone wins, right?
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's doable. I you know, based on what I know about the architecture, I think it'll take time and effort, but I think it is doable. And I do think that, you know, I certainly would be willing to spend some time validating some fixes, because most of the issues come up pretty quickly.
So I think my takeaway from this conversation is that Apple needs something like web services or Windows Azure, where you can put some kind of brains up in the cloud that is somehow tied to the iCloud data storage.
Is that I think that would be great.
I don't know if I see that happening.
I don't know if I see it happening either. But no. It seems to me that would be. I mean, that would solve all of your problems, right? More or less.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like Brent, we got approached by Microsoft as well, and they were offering us money to start moving NetNewsWire over to, you know, the mobile services stuff. And, you know, we talked about it, but we were in the middle of shipping Kaleidoscope. And, you know, part of what they were saying was like, you need to do it by this time because there's going to be a marketing event associated with this. Yeah. And we're like, there's no way we can hit that. So we said no. But I have never, ever, ever heard of anybody being paid money by Apple to develop something using their technology.
No, even back in the old days, 97, 98, maybe.
That goes back beyond before me. Mm-hmm. I was crashing things on Mars back then.
No, but you're right. It's just not something they do ever. Yeah, asking somebody.
Yeah, saying, hey, would you do this? Yeah, I mean, that happens. But not with money. No, I don't remember that.
They'll put you up on stage if you do it.
No, you know, they bought me a computer once.
Did they?
Or actually, they bought Dave Weiner a computer, and then Dave gave it to me because he didn't need a computer. Because he had a computer. So I got a new computer. So it had to do with, I can't remember, it was scripting, language, evangelism kind of thing, whatever. So, you know, they, as a token of something, they decided to buy a computer for Dave. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not like they bought it. They just sent you one from their backyard.
Yeah, exactly. Right, yeah. But the thing is, I'm still using the Apple Extended 2 keyboard from that computer.
So you tainted everything. Like, literally everything you type about Apple is like.
That's right. I forgot about that. That is where this comes from. Yeah. I've been using this free keyboard since 1996 or something, which I love.
Is it the same one still?
Yeah. Yeah. If it dies, my career's over.
Syracuse has a pile of them, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
It's going to sell them to you for a shitload of money, but still.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Anybody want to pimp anything?
NetNewsWire, when it ships, it's going to be awesome.
Yep. I'm really excited for that.
Yeah, me too.
I'm very tense.
Oh, yeah? Seriously?
Well, I just take it seriously, you know. I want it to be really good. And, you know, I think that I've got big shoes to fill. So,
I mean, Kaleidoscope came out well. So, you know, I've got faith that you guys will do a good job.
Thank you. I hope to do that justice.
I have nothing to pimp, but someday, hopefully soon, I will. In the interim, go check out Wolfpack. It's my new open source image compositing library. GitHub.com/Justin. You'll find a link on there. So,
cool.
Working on all kinds of crazy stuff. Just nothing to share yet. I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing.
Brent, you're not pimping anything yet, are you?
No, I got nothing. I got no software. I got no nothing.
You got Glassboard.
So yeah, I use Glassboard. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're so independent. You have actually nothing. I am actually walking
free of everything. Yeah, or walking my office anyway.
You're like Kwai Chang Kane.
Cool. So, Brent, how do people find you on Twitter? Or anywhere?
They find me mildly amusing at times, mainly quiet. Or
not very funny, though.
That was very profound.
Brent Simmons on Twitter and on app.net.
Yeah. All right, I got some. You know what? I will put this somewhere, but I got a link for 75 ADN memberships for fans of mine, which is
cool.
Weird. Yeah. At Justin.
Yeah, at Justin on the Twitter, on the app.net. I'm trying to write on the blog more, carpeaqua.com, if you can spell that.
It'll be in the show notes.
Cool. Pasco?
DL Pasco on the Twitter and on ADN.
What's the L stand for?
Lee. I've always included that for a long time. D Pasco just sounds so impersonal.
Like Bruce Lee? Sorry. I'm going to go now.
And blackpixel.com, right, Dan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks, guys. Had a lot of fun chatting. And I'm sure I'll run into you all sometime during this year.